Our last case this morning is Disciplinary Council versus Gorby, 14541. Mr. Davis.
Good morning. Madam Chief Justice, members of the court, my name is Bruce Davis and I represent the Office of Disciplinary Counsel. We're later in this matter. The Office of Disciplinary Counsel objects to the report of the Board of Commissioners for the following three reasons. The Board's focus on the familial relationship between the respondent and the grievant is misplaced. The Board's analysis of pertinent case law and aggravating and mitigating factors is flawed. And adopting the Board's recommendation of sanction in this case would be inconsistent with all previous misappropriation precedent and set a dangerous precedent in that area of law. The report of the Board of Commissioners can be reduced to two sentences. Those are the first two sentences in paragraph 61 of the report, which state, while this panel certainly does not condone the actions of respondent, it is somewhat concerning that respondent's otherwise unblemished record should become the target of a disciplinary investigation because of the acrimonious relationship with her sister. The panel does not excuse her for the violation of these rules, yet we must recognize that this is a family feud boiled over into this process. This case is not about sisters. This case is not about a family feud. This is a case about an attorney who stole thousands of dollars from her client.
How much money was taken?
$5,500, Your Honor.
And how much was paid back in restitution?
The entire sum was paid back in restitution after the respondent was contacted by disciplinary counsel.
So there's no restitution owed, and the financial situation has been restored.
That's correct, Your Honor.
All right.
So she didn't pay it back, though, until there was a complaint, correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
All right. I have to think that because the sisters engaged one another in this attorney-client, that they must have had a decent relationship at the onset? Was there any indication that it was a feuding situation and one sister went ahead and engaged the other one as a lawyer?
The only testimony that was given at the hearing was that the respondent felt that her sister, the grievant, often took advantage of her position as an attorney.
So she decided to take advantage of her bank account? I mean, what's that all about?
I would be speculating, but the respondent testified to the fact that she had a hard time differentiating between her professional relationship and her personal relationship with the grievant, but offered no reasonable explanation of why the acrimonious relationship or her animosity towards her sister would justify her ability to use the client funds basically as her own personal ATM. She paid for business expenses, childcare expenses. She paid her registration dues to the Supreme Court of Ohio with stolen funds. So there was no evidence given as to why this would be acceptable behavior. And the respondent herself testified that she knew that she was not allowed to use those funds for anything other than the resolution of the property action with her sister.
Just a couple of things. There were no fees charged for representation at any point in this situation?
That is correct. The respondent did not charge the grievant, nor was there ever a fee agreement.
And the use of the IOLTA, it was almost as if it were a personal bank account. There were monies put in by the respondent into the account as well, correct?
There was actually no IOLTA account at all, Your Honor. She was using her operating account. So while the proper procedure, the ethically compliant procedure, would be to place those client funds and hold them in an IOLTA, she was using her business checking account to hold those fees and then, as you said, was drawing out of that to pay personal and business expenses and then later put personal money in there to compensate her sister.
So there was no fee that was put into this account by her sister or from her sister. What money was really the Adams money in that account?
Instead of paying their mortgage, the advice was given by respondent that the money should be held by her to later deal with the foreclosure action. So she was almost acting like an escrow account for her clients. So the Adams's money was being held, should have been held in trust, but was being held by Ms. Gorby to later deal with the foreclosure action and try to negotiate a settlement with the bank. That's not what ended up happening, but that was the intention.
What ended up happening? What happened to the Adams as a result of this?
The court found for the mortgage bank, and the property was foreclosed on, but not enforced. So a judgment was found for the bank, but the Adamses did end up keeping their property and restructuring their mortgage.
So they redeemed it in some way with the mortgage company, and they used the $5,500 in order to do that?
They did not. The judgment and the later renegotiation with the bank occurred before the respondent paid the restitution.
Okay, so I guess what I'm trying to figure out is, was the sister and brother-in-law, were they disadvantaged with the mortgage company as a result of the attorney utilizing their escrowed funds, so to speak?
There's no evidence to support that.
Okay, so they didn't have any fees. They made she made restitution. They were not damaged in their dealings with their mortgage holder. They were able to hold on to their property. And then after all that took place, they filed a grievance against Attorney Gorby.
The grievance was motivated by the fact that Ms. Gorby would not return the funds, and her clients were requesting the return of those funds. She simply...
How long did she hold on to them after they requested that she release them to them?
There were multiple requests for the funds. Many of them happened over text and phone calls that we don't have a definitive record of, but it was a matter of months.
Months?
Yes.
10 months? 1 month? 2 months?
I think it's closer to 2 months.
2 months, okay. And so my understanding is that she cashed in part of a husband's retirement account in order to pay them back.
Yes, Your Honor. The only way that she was able to make restitution was by raiding her husband's 401k.
Presumably with his approval.
Presumably.
Why do you use the word raiding then?
Raiding?
Yeah.
I use that word because of the implied tax penalties and the fact that it's an undesirable way to come up with money. Ms. Gorby at the hearing tried to make the argument that she didn't really steal the funds. The funds of her clients were just in a different account. And I think that's a ridiculous claim given the fact that if you're taking money out of a 401k, obviously the contributions to the 401k did not come from the client funds. And with the attendant penalties and tax consequences, that would be an account of last resort out of which to pay restitution.
Counsel, I'm having trouble with your characterization this morning when you say this is not a case of feuding sisters. My reading of the board's report is that the respondent has been representing her sister for free for what, going on 20 years now?
I don't think she's been an attorney for 20 years.
Well, since she's been admitted to the practice of law, anytime her sister got in trouble, she represented her for free, correct?
She did make that representation.
She held off a bank, and they ended up keeping Black Acre in Mahoning County, correct?
No, she did not hold off the bank. The judgment was found for the bank, and totally outside of the judicial process were the Adamses able to renegotiate a mortgage.
Did the bank go in and seize the house on the day that they filed the complaint in foreclosure?
No.
Probably took a little while, didn't it?
Yes.
So you don't think that's holding off the bank?
I don't think we have enough evidence to make a determination.
I want to be clear on what you want today, or your office wants today. The board has suggested 1 year suspended, all stayed, correct?
Correct.
What do you want?
The precedent in this misappropriation area of law would dictate a year suspension with none of it stayed. Any other result would be inconsistent with the case law for a couple of reasons. The most analogous cases here are Birchinall and Deal. In that case, both of the respondents served 6 months actual suspension, but that was in large part due to mental health mitigation evidence that they presented, which was very significant. In this case, there was no mental health mitigation evidence, and it was not a contributing factor to her misconduct. In this case, the misconduct was motivated solely by greed and her animosity towards her client. To stay the suspension entirely would be to demean the significance of mental health mitigation evidence in these cases, which is incredibly important, and this court has found time and time again to be one of the most important mitigating factors, as it should be. So if Ms. Gorby, because of her misconduct, her theft of thousands of dollars from her client, if she should receive a lesser sanction than Birchinol and Deal, what message does that send to the bar in Ohio?
What about the Fumic case that the panel relied on?
The reliance on Fumic is entirely misplaced. They seem to argue, the board seems to argue, that Fumic stands for the premise that if you engage in misconduct against a client who is a family member, it is less egregious than if you would engage in similar conduct against a stranger. That's not what Fumic says. In fact, in the portion of the decision which the sanction is discussed, the familial relationship isn't even mentioned once. The reliance on Fumic is grasping at straws, trying to justify a result and a sanction. Fumic is entirely dissimilar from the case here today. Fumic is not even a misappropriation case. Fumic is a case about an attorney who was representing an estate of a family member who, when the case was dismissed because it had no merit whatsoever, he felt bad about that and paid the family money which the case never merited. It's the opposite of misappropriation. It was literally charity. He lied about it, which was the basis of the 8.4C violation, but he did not steal his client's money. In fact, he gave the clients $16,000 that their case never deserved. So these cases are entirely separate. I should also point out that in Fumic, that respondent, Mr. Fumic, presented with a large amount of mitigation evidence and countless references to both his character and his ability as an attorney. Ms. Gorby presented not a single character letter and not a single reference to her professional competence. So when we look at the mitigation and aggravation evidence and factors in this case, we have a mountain of aggravating factors.
Counsel, before you get to aggravating, I want to make sure I understand your answer to the chief a little while ago. It looks to me from the record that the first demand for the $5,500 happened on November 28th. When the bankruptcy lawyer said, can I have half of the $5,500 back, correct?
Depends on who you are asking, which party.
I'm just reading from the board's findings of fact that are before us.
That is incorrect. The grievant requested the money back previous to the grievance being filed.
Okay, then you're saying the board is wrong that the first request was on November 28th?
Yes, the first.
Because it looks to me like the money was paid back 2 weeks later, and you said 2 months.
Right. The first request from the bankruptcy attorney was made at that date. But originally, it was the grievant who asked, I believe, over the phone and over text messages for the money back, and Ms. Gorby said, no, I will not give it back to you. But you're correct on the date of the request from the bankruptcy attorney, but not from the
grievant. Where do I find that in the record before me, the verbal request?
I'm not sure exactly where it is.
I'm reading the entire findings. I don't see that anywhere. I see that the lawyer asked for the money on November 28th, and he received the money on December 7th.
That is correct, that the lawyer did request it on that date.
Okay.
In looking at the aggregating factors in this case, the evidence supports three additional aggravating factors that the board did not find. Those factors are a lack of cooperation with the disciplinary process, a submission of false statements to disciplinary counsel, and that would be stipulated Exhibit 2, and a refusal to acknowledge the wrongful nature of her conduct. Both at her deposition and at the hearing, Ms. Gorby said time and time again, I did not violate 8.4C. While she stipulated the fact that her conduct was motivated by a dishonest and selfish motive, she refused to accept responsibility and refused to admit that her conduct was engaging in misrepresentation and dishonesty. She had no rational explanation for why she would not admit to this conduct, and in fact, she had stipulated to the 8.4C violation a month previous. The morning of the hearing, she signed a new original of the stipulation stipulating to the 8.4C violation. And then a half hour later, when she was on the stand, she said, I did not violate 8.4C. Her conduct during the disciplinary process and during the hearing must be considered by this court when determining the appropriate sanction. And her conduct during this process shows three more aggravating factors which should be considered. On the mitigating side of the balance, she has only one mitigating factor, and that is that she has not been subject to discipline previously. So when we balance the aggravating factors in this case and mitigating factors as compared to Deal and Birchenall, it is clear that a sanction more significant than Deal and Birchenall is warranted to protect the public.
Well, that isn't exactly what the panel found, though, is it?
No, we are asking part
they
of our-
They found she was full and free disclosure, cooperative attitude toward all proceedings, timely and good faith effort to make restitution, and restitution was made in full.
We disagree.
So there are mitigating factors found by the panel that apparently you are discounting. Is that correct?
We disagree with those findings, Your Honor.
All right. Thank you.
The finding that she cooperated and gave full and free disclosure is contradicted by her behavior at the hearing. And it's contradicted by the fact that she lied.
Why isn't that reflected in the panel's report then?
They decided not to make that finding, which is why we objected.
Well, we weren't there. They're not here. We have to rely on what they tell us in writing, don't we?
And the transcript, Your Honor. I believe a review of the transcript of the hearing will show that she did not fully cooperate, and the fact that she walked away from her stipulations that she had signed a half an hour previous does not constitute cooperation with the process,
right,
nor
thank
full
you.
And free disclosure.
Was she represented?
She was not. Yes, she appeared pro se at the hearing.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
We'll take the matter under advisement, and you'll be notified of our decision. Marshall, will you please adjourn?
All rise. Hear ye, hear ye.